Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday. It's the 4th of November. Very nice to have you. First Monday of November, and we are very, very thrilled that you are with us. We have a great panel, a wonderful, wonderful group assembled. Let me introduce them to you. A reminder, you can join us in the conversation simply by writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is in the house. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Yo, just raring to go.
Excellent, excellent. Good way to be. Also, we welcome Sarah Rogerson, Albany Law School professor, director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning.
How are you?
Great.
Political consultant Libby Post is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here.
Good morning.
And we are thrilled because our good friend Jim Ketterer, who is was at Bard College, still with Bard, but then left us several months ago to go to Egypt. He is the dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University in Cairo. He had to come back to go to a wedding, and we strong-armed him into coming and doing the show. And we're thrilled that you're here.
I'm thrilled to be here. It's good to be back at WAMC, to feel some fall weather, to vote in my local elections, all of that.
So now you're still but you're a senior fellow at Bard.
At the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, right?
Yep. And then the gig at American University, the American University in Cairo. How's everything in Egypt?
Good. So I would just, as a brief description about what I'm doing there, the American University in Cairo is a very prestigious university. It's having its 100th anniversary this year, and the school that I oversee is a school that reaches out to the broad swath of Egyptian society. We have over 23,000 students a year who are studying every kind of thing you can imagine, for languages, academic enrichment, advancing their careers. And my office is in Tahrir Square, and it's interesting and engaging, and it's while it's nice to be back, it's also good to be there and to be working for, I think, what's a really important mission of this school.
So we have always counted on you for many, many years to help us in understanding politics, geopolitics, what is going on in our world at large, and how all these pieces come together. Since you left us, I mean, obviously, major things have happened. There have been these incredible shifts, and I'm wondering, for you, has there been any real difference in watching this from Egypt as opposed to watching it from the Hudson Valley of New York?
You know, I think it's always interesting to look back at one's own country from overseas and to see how people are reacting to the news, you know, this constantly surprising news from Washington, from Cairo and from around Egypt, and to see, you know, how people are quite surprised at the sort of the situation that the United States is in, to see the United States political institutions so stress tested. It's definitely gotten people's attention. And so that's an interesting perspective. The other part of it is, too, is that so in terms of the Middle East itself, you know, across the region, the Middle East and North Africa, there's a lot going on. And that's not all reported on so well when you're just in the U.S. And I know Rosemary has spent lots of time there, too. So when you're there and you can get different perspectives, not just from other news sources, but talk to people, you know, kind of the old-fashioned version of getting to know what's going on, actually talk to people. Yeah.
And they all are willing to talk about it, too.
Yeah, I think that's an important corrective to just, you know, following the headlines. No matter how good a news outlet might be, that's just one slice of a much more complicated picture.
Well, speaking of complicated pictures, let's begin our discussion this morning. We're thrilled you're here, and thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to your thoughts on our stories for the day. So the article in the Washington Post this morning is headlined, "A Presidential Loathing for Ukraine is at the Heart of the Impeachment Inquiry." And this is basically a discussion that so far a dozen witnesses have testified before House lawmakers since the closed-door impeachment inquiry began a month ago. One theme that runs through almost all of their accounts is Trump's unyielding loathing of Ukraine, which dates to his earliest days in the White House, calling them horrible, corrupt people. He says that the more that those around him pushed in the Oval Office, the more that Trump resisted. According to this article, three of President Trump's top advisors met with him in the Oval Office in May, determined to convince him that the new Ukrainian leader was an ally deserving of U.S. support. They had barely begun their pitch when Trump unloaded on them, according to current and former U.S. officials familiar with the meeting. In Trump's mind, the official said Ukraine's entire leadership had colluded with the Democrats to undermine the 2016 presidential campaign. They tried to take me down, Trump railed. Energy Secretary Rick Perry, the senior member of the group, assured Trump that the new Ukrainian president was different, a reformer in Trump's mold, who had even quoted President Reagan in his inaugural address, for which the three advisors had been present. But again, the harder they pushed, the more that the president resisted. And then, of course, now we are where we are as far as the impeachment inquiry. Trump's animosity to Ukraine ran so deep and was so resistant to the typical foreign policy entreaties about the need to stand up by allies that senior officials involved in Ukraine policy concluded that the only way to overcome it was to set up an Oval Office meeting with Trump and the new Ukrainian president.
Well, you know, to me, it kept hitting me in the face that when Nancy Pelosi said to Trump, "All roads lead to Putin." You got to figure that the Russians are no fans of the Ukrainians. In fact, are at war with them. So therefore, to me, this is just one more nail in the pro-Putin plank of Trump that he had had his marching orders either directly or indirectly. And had decided that the Ukrainians were bad because they were bad for Putin.
I want to hit the journalists because journalism is behind this BuzzFeed, which got knocked by both Mueller and the Trump people when they came out and said the lawyer Cohen was forced to testify and forced to lie by Trump. Do you remember that story?
Sure.
And they refused to apologize. They go, no, we support our reporting and we're going to keep on reporting it. And the memos upon which these stories are based came from an extended freedom of information fight led by BuzzFeed and other journalists, but mostly BuzzFeed. And they came out with 500 memos that were behind the Mueller report. And they show and trace this obsession with a conspiracy that no one else seems to believe. And it also shows, I think, that Mueller did a really lousy job. There was a lot more there. And it makes you really wonder how that whole investigation was carried out. It seemed to be more about containing the information coming out than expanding it.
I want to just say, Rosemary, for whatever it's worth, that I completely agree with you about the Mueller report. I really think he did a lousy job.
Yep.
And I think
it's becoming clear.
Yes. And I think that we were all so invested in what was going to happen as a result of the Mueller report that when it came out and it stunk, he pulled in his horns, that we were all loath to criticize him, but he deserves criticism.
Yeah. And I think that that story was a huge blockbuster, and it came out on a weekend, which doesn't help. It came out on a weekend when Trump was booed at MMA, which is a lot more visual and auditory than this. But a long fight to get records has vindicated the reporting and has thrown the Mueller report into doubt.
What story? I'm sorry.
That BuzzFeed got 500 of the memos that were attached to the Mueller report. They were kept secret up to now, but they buttress what's in the report.
Sure.
And when you read them, and I've just started to, there's 500 pages of this stuff. It's another book.
For you, it's a piece of cheese.
If I didn't have a dinner party, I would have had them read by now this weekend. But they're fascinating, and they show how invested that campaign was in getting the emails from Hillary. He worked to get them. It wasn't just an offhand little joke saying, hey, Russians, if you're listening, get them. He worked on it. And Manafort as I've always been suspicious of Manafort. What was that guy doing in Ukraine, and how did he end up at the Trump campaign? And so, it's all in there.
I was in Ukraine in 2014, and I was there with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. That's a mouthful. Yep. And I was just there as an election observer for about 2.5 weeks. So not a terribly long time, but long enough, especially during that time, to get a sense of what a very complicated place it is, what a difficult situation is. And talking about being on the front lines, this is I was there after the Crimea, after Crimea was taken over by the Russians. The battle for the airport in Donetsk was raging. In the part of the country that I was in, they were having one military funeral after another, young people who had been drafted into that battle. I mean, this is a place that's truly on the front lines. And when I think about the connections between foreign policy, which sometimes I think feels abstract and distant to people, and then the WAMC area, there are a lot of Ukrainian Americans here. And I would be interested in hearing their perspective when the president of the United States says it's not even a real country. And that, you know, this is the sort of thing that I think those communities here, and not just Ukrainian Americans, everybody should be asking their members of Congress. So what do you think about this?
And the other talking point, Jim, is, oh, well, they're not in any treaties with us. The reason they're not in NATO is that we said, no, that'll cause too much trouble with Putin. You don't have to be in it. We will protect you. We will act as if you are in the NATO. And then they didn't.
And we didn't. And that was before Trump. And that was happening when I was there.
That was Obama.
When we were signatory to an agreement that said if they gave up their nuclear weapons, we would help to guarantee their territorial integrity. When that territorial integrity was violated, we did not live up to our commitments. And I had conversations with other people from other NATO countries when I was there, some diplomats who said, well, would you go to war to protect us under Article 5 of the NATO Charter? And so these things have serious implications. And there's lots that we can focus on with the current president of the U.S., but it started before that.
Your point about the Ukrainian relationship with the United States was overwhelmingly reinforced with me as I took the 79th Street crosstown the other day and saw this gigantic embassy that the Ukrainians have in this country.
But the thing that hit me from this article that I'm hoping we'll get through in some kind of messaging is that this is a president running foreign policy by transaction and not values. And I think that it totally undermines who we are and what the country is supposed to be as a world leader.
Could you define transaction for all of us?
Oh, sure. I'll give you that money if you give me the dirt on Biden.
Personal transaction.
Right.
Well,
it's a personal
you see
thing.
That in Hong Kong, too, where why are we not on the side of the people fighting the communists, fighting the oligarchs, fighting the power? Why are we not on the side of democracy and peace? And we're not. And I don't think we're going to be.
No, we won't be.
Hong Kong will Trump will use that in whatever way helps him to win a trade war with China.
He'll take away Ivanka's privileges. Yes.
And, her copyrights.
Sarah?
So much of international relations relies on normative development, right? Informal arrangements, patterns of behavior over
values.
Time. And values. And what we're seeing is America taking a back seat.
Okay, I'll buy normative.
How you should do things, shoulda rather than.
Well, okay, just because we have a wide audience, and I also just want to make sure that when we use these kinds of words, we.
It's also, norms are also act outside of the law, right? So a lot of international law is formed by the way that people behave around each other that then becomes law as opposed to law that's passed by any international organization. And so, did I do all right, Jim?
Yeah.
So I'm speaking in your wheelhouse now, but so much of how the world operates depends on the United States being a leader, being a defender of human rights, living up to its promises, and as you said, for many decades.
So what do you ascribe that to, Sarah?
Ascribe what to?
The motives that we go outside those normal or norms.
I think there's a lot that has to do with what Trump tapped into, which was energy in the country long before he became president, which is America needs to look out for Americans.
And so you're not buying onto the Shartakian Putin at all costs.
I think that was an accelerant. That was like dumping kerosene on a smoldering fire, as it were. There's been a backlash to globalization that's been going on since for several decades.
And from both the right and the left.
Right.
So. And a backlash to working within the normal institutional constraints of American foreign policy, the way the business is generally done, no matter who's the president and what party is in power.
So are you guys saying it really is, you know, what's good for Trump as opposed to what's good for the country? I want to keep it simple.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said that from the very beginning. He said that in his inaugural address. I'm the only one who can fix this. And about the State Department, I'm the only one that matters. So he has had no problem just stripping that department of people and ambassadors, not appointing people.
Yeah, but that's true. That's absolutely true, Rosemary. But it doesn't get to the point of his personal needs, the personal needs of Donald Trump as opposed to the needs of the country.
This is all about his personal needs.
Yeah.
All of it.
You know, and that's a long strain in American history, too. The Dulles brothers, who ran the CIA and the State Department under Eisenhower, felt they were businessmen. And their view was, do what's good for them because they are business, and what's good for business is good for America.
Right.
So that's a long strain in America.
Well,
Trump
yes, except that the Dulles brothers were talking about business writ large, whereas Trump is talking about what's good for Donald Trump and his family.
Right. But he equates himself as one of that group. Remember when he went into the steakhouse in New York early in his reign and said, hey, you guys, I'm going to take care of your taxes. I'm going to fix up things for you. He sees himself as one with the big businessmen of the world, country.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. A lot of good meaty stuff this morning, so we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org.
Want to use you for my friend.
Boz Skaggs, we are hearing this morning, playing tonight at The Egg at 8 o'clock, theegg.org, and at the Calvin in Northampton on Thursday, IHEG.com, and the playlist on our website, WAMC.org/roundtable. Let's go to some letters, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
Okay, so Sue says, hello, panel. We are very much need to focus on our local elections and Trumpism in this microcosm. We need to talk about Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin.
Sounds like Q Libby.
Oh, my God.
And the audio that was released so over the weekend. Thank you, Sue. So could somebody explain to all of us?
Yes, yes. There's a mayoral race going on in Troy. It's a three-way. Rodney Wilshire is on the independent, I think maybe Working Families line. He ran against Madden in the primary and lost. Pat Madden, who's a Democrat, and Chris Reel, I think his first name is Chris, who was the Republican nominee. 3 to 4 weeks ago, he dropped out of the race for whatever reason.
And what was the reason?
Family reasons.
Family reasons.
Okay, folks, air quotes, family reasons. Well, he decided to get back. Last week, he got back in the race, held a press conference on Friday, and released tapes of the conversation. It wasn't even a conversation. The tirade that he put up with from County Executive Steve McLaughlin, his henchman, Rich Crist, Jim Walsh, I think, was also there. I'm not sure if I'm correct about that, but there was another guy who was there. And as Henry Higgins says, he used language that would make a sailor blush. That's all I have to say. It was nothing you can say on the air, but it has to do with one's mother and an anatomical part. And so it was really, really quite bad. And this is available online.
First name is
Tom. Oh, Tom Reel. Okay. Yeah. He's available online at the TU site if you want to listen to this tirade. And
out of the race.
Yes, he was ordering him out of the race, threatening him and his family, threatening every Senate Republican from the area. He works for Daphne Jordan, who's a new state senator who took Marchione's seat. And he threatened the petitioning process for that seat and anyone else that his Republicans were going to support. I mean, it was that real support, real Republicans were going to support. I mean, it's
and this is the county executive.
This is the county executive.
And why was he doing this?
Because, well,
he's the boss of Rensselaer County.
He's the boss of Rensselaer County. He runs the show. Rich Crist is his henchman. And
do what I say.
Yeah, do what I say. I mean, I've heard horrible, horrible things about people being threatened.
I thought this stuff just went on in Cohoes. No.
Or North Jersey.
Yeah. No, I would think South Jersey.
It's actually worse than North Jersey. Yeah, that I cut my political teeth in Essex County, New Jersey. And what I read in that TU article.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's shameful. It brings shame upon the county exec's office. This is who Steve McLaughlin is. We know that during the race, another recording came out of him threatening a woman, and he got elected by the skin of his teeth.
Yep.
I know someone who used to advise him who is no longer on the planet, and so there's no one now reining this man in and getting him to do a little self-censorship.
And there's a reason why he's no longer in the legislature.
Yes.
So what
yes.
will happen on Tuesday, tomorrow?
Oh, Pat Madden will win. There's no two ways about it. Pat Madden's going to win the race. The idea that getting real out and that people would vote for Wilshire and that would be enough is really statistically absurd.
Trumpism.
Can I just say something, too, that this is going to sound like a joke, and I suppose it is sort of, but I don't mean it as a joke. And that is that for whenever people say to me, like, oh, you know, the Middle East is such a difficult place and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think people are need to take a hard look at what really goes on in our own politics and the nature of our own political system. And, you know, this is sort of a glimpse into it, but it's not that hard to figure out.
But is
out
it
anyway.
Typical? This is really outside.
More tickled typical than we want to
I think it happens more than we think. It's just that this guy, Real, had the wherewithal to tape it and keep it as evidence and to get handed over. I mean, his career with the Republican Party is probably over, but he's standing up on principles. A rare Republican who is standing up on principles and values, and he's a veteran and, you know, really doing what the right thing to do here.
Yep.
All right. Thank you for that letter.
Okay. And
that was a diversion, man.
That was great.
Well, I think we specialize in that. I'm part of the problem.
People need to know.
We're the ADHD crew over here.
Kathy from Ukraine says about Ukraine. Don't forget, it was the July 2016 when the GOP leadership met with Trump, who was the nominee apparent. Coming out of that meeting, we were all stunned to learn that the GOP had changed its official platform to withdraw support for Ukraine in favor of Russia.
Right.
And here we are, 3+ years later, talking about the GOP and Ukraine and Russia. I continue to ask, what happened in that meeting of July 2016? Why did the GOP go along? What did they get? And who has the proof? Trump?
It was a change in the platform,
And Manafort was the chairman at the time, campaign chairman. Mm-hmm. And I keep wondering, if he gets pardoned, would there be additional charges against him? I mean, I think he is way blacker than he has been so far painted.
All right. And Robert says, Trump, Putin. I'll say again, this has been choreographed by Putin. That's good, because I said it earlier in the thing. Yeah. Trump on the world stage said, maybe we can be friends with Russia. He sure did in the beginning. I love the Russians, he said. And Leslie said, the game may very well be lost. Almost half the country is willing to look past the obvious and support Trump. The Democrats are playing by the rules, rules which are inadequate to deal with our current situation. The danger we now face is not just Trump, but the degenerate GOP. The country will not recover until the GOP is viewed as being abhorrent as the Klan and the Nazi parties. Whoa.
Wow.
That's from Leslie.
That's a sign of our times.
Well, is that it?
Yeah, that's it, Joe.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I just want to say, let's look at what happens tomorrow. It's a local election day. And
very
if
important.
We have some very overwhelming blue victories, Democratic victories in purple and red areas, it's just a continuation of last year's blue wave.
Right.
And I think I'm hopeful.
What places are you looking at, Libby? What will make a difference?
Well, there's one particular race out in the 6th Judicial District, which is this triangle from Delaware to Schuyler, including Broome, up to Tompkins County, and it's very likely that a Democratic woman will be elected to
just
state
the
Supreme Court.
Just for our
race.
Purposes, you don't have a role in that.
Yes,
one.
I do.
Okay, well,
okay.
That's very important to say.
Yes, I am. I'm running the campaign for this woman, Claudette Newman, and you know, it's very likely that she's going to win, and this is going to be a continuation of the blue wave. Let's see what happens in Colony. I'm not working on any of those races, whether or not George Scaringe, who's a GOP stronghold, right? He was the party for a very long time. Can be Paula Mahon in an area that's sort of purple. Mm-hmm. Colony is not solidly blue; it is purple. And so I think we're going to see the continuation of the blue wave, because I really do think the more Trump does what he does, the more it angers the base. Now,
okay,
the
just for the
and
sake of debate,
get out.
What if we don't see that? What if we see the opposite?
Then we have to work harder.
Yeah, I saw reporting over the weekend that that Republicans have lost about 18,000 voters from their rolls, and Democrats have gained 250,000 in New York
in
State
New York.
Alone.
Right,
a quarter
and
million.
That
so if
being
we fail,
New York.
Right. But early voting
in
this state, the numbers I'm seeing for early voting is overwhelmingly Democratic.
But how about if we look around, and so we look around the country, we got a race in Virginia, right? So
and Kentucky.
And Kentucky.
Right. And Kentucky's very important.
Yes. Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, the race in Virginia, the genius put out, I think, on Twitter that they're doing so well because it's all Republican in Virginia, and somebody else corrected him to say, no, the governor and the lieutenant governor are Democrats.
Yeah.
Moron.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll take your letters, and we'll read them if you send them. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, James Ketterer, Sarah Rogerson, Rosemary Romeo, and Libby Post. We will be back right after this short break. Good morning. Thank you very much for being back with us and being a part of our roundtable panel for this Monday morning. It's the 4th of November, panel@WAMC.org, and you can write to us there, panel@WAMC.org. Let's go back to other stories. And one of the things that happened over the weekend that we did not get to talk about is Beto O'Rourke is out of the race. Mm-hmm. We've lost a candidate, and what was considered to be a major, when he started, people thought he could be a real playmaker. So Beto
I sure as hell didn't.
Beto O'Rourke is out of the race, and he quit amid financial strains and lagging popularity. And but don't worry, there are still 17 candidates in the race. So,
well, when you talk about his motivation, you got to figure he was successful in one way. He kept his name alive. Right out there.
Well, in a way, though, the way he ran the campaign assures that he can't really run successfully for, say, the Senate in Texas when I'm coming after your guns, he's finished.
Because?
Because it's a very red state and a very strong Second Amendment state, and he's positioned himself now as someone who's a liberal on gun control.
I don't know. I lived there for a couple of years, and I helped organize the Walk for Change for Obama, that big kickoff event. And even back then, Texas was increasingly purple. Keep an eye on Texas.
That's the hope they'll take it over, but he hasn't allowed himself time or money raising or position, philosophical position.
So why did he do it?
To run. I don't know.
Cabinet secretary?
Well,
positioning himself.
I think a lot of these guys who thought that they might be running for cabinet secretary have now been so poorly received that one would think twice about it. For example, the mayor of New York, Mr. de Blasio.
Yeah.
I mean, poison at this stage.
I think Beto really thought he could do it. He had a campaign manager who was fantastic, Jen O'Malley. Yeah. She ran Obama's field operation. She is the reason
so
we
So where did they fail?
It's a crowded field.
I think it's him.
I do too.
I think it's him.
Meaning?
I think his personality is
I think it was
his
cover story.
How would you describe his personality?
It was his cover story, and I can't remember if it was
Whiffy.
If it was
Rolling Stone.
It was Rolling Stone, and I think the caption was, "I was born for this," or something.
Yeah, it's like, give me
a break.
But then when he got down to it, he goes, "Oh, it seems like it'd be a fun thing to do." It was weird. It was
not serious.
Against Ted Cruz, he looked pretty good, but against the 24 candidates, all of whom have interesting and authentic stories.
Great
he
point,
just
Rosemary.
He just never measured up.
He resonated with Gen Xers like me, I think. He wouldn't have been my choice for other reasons, but he, you know, he was the skateboarder kind of. He didn't take things seriously, because when the El Paso shootings happened, he had a very impassioned response. He was a very human interaction with the press. I believe that he is going to lead in America, just maybe not as president.
All right. They have arrived. We have new letters just in. We'll go to those, and then we'll...
New letters just in.
Yes.
Hot off the press. Okay, McLaughlin. When McLaughlin took office, he said he would not enforce the SAFE Act. Why isn't he being investigated and charged? And that's from Jim.
Anybody?
Deafening silence. Okay.
How do you go after someone? I mean,
no, you really don't.
It's not the county executive who does that. It's the police department.
Not only that, you would help him.
Yeah.
In a particular range. So
you would get to be the victim of...
Yeah. Trump's move to Florida. This is an interesting one. In addition to being at odds with most of New York's government and judicial system, I believe Trump wants to move to Florida ASAP to get ahead of the impending firestorm of prosecution from his now ex-state New York. And that's Mark from Livingston Manor.
No, just because you moved doesn't mean
that's a big question. The governor brought that up, did he not? That he's looking for a loophole in the law that would let him escape some prosecution?
Yeah. He also
said, does that actually exist? A loophole means it does exist, and he can do
maybe.
It.
Maybe.
He also had the best remark of all when he left. He said,
good riddance.
Good riddance.
I know.
Not as if he was paying taxes anyway. I get that. But I did wonder about the prosecution thing. Do we know for sure?
Well,
his lawyer, can he really get out of prosecution?
I think the bill that got passed was predicated on the fact that he had to give up his New York State taxes because he lived here. Now, whether or not he would still have to give them up because...
He doesn't live here.
But they're past. They were filed in the past when he did live here. So it remains to be seen.
Well, anyway.
It could be at least a point that he could drag out in court for several months.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And we heard from writer Kevin, who says...
I
don't want to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
And we heard from writer Kevin, who said, Trump collusion. Can any self-respecting Republican really say that the Mueller report is a witch hunt? He did the same thing with Putin as he did with Zelensky. We just didn't have a transcript. Any doubters are full-fledged traitors.
It's fighting words.
Silence around the room. Teresa says, whistleblower. Trump is calling for the outing of the whistleblower, whose identity, as I understand it, is protected by federal law. Yeah. Is Trump committing a crime by doing this? The answer is no. I mean, it's not a crime. On the other hand, the point is extremely well taken by Teresa.
Outing him would be a crime.
Yes.
Calling for a crime to be committed, I don't think is really a crime.
Well, it's like yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Exactly. And this goes along with the same Trump policy on Julian Assange, not a man I admire, but he is a whistleblower as well. And Trump's charges against him, the Trump administration's charges against him, are also way overblown and outrageous.
Against Assange?
Yes.
Well, yeah, but let's not forget that Obama... And that administration was also seeking to prosecute Assange.
I have never defended Obama on
whistleblower.
But actually, the Trump administration has gone beyond Obama on what they want to bring against
Assange. So let's go back to the meat of this from Teresa. We know, of course, that it turns out that the whistleblower was absolutely right about everything he said.
Right.
And also, it doesn't matter anymore. Because they've had all these other witnesses who have said basically they were on the call, they heard about the call, and in fact, all of the stuff that the whistleblower told us was true.
And that the whistleblower is now saying that they will interact directly with the Republicans in the House committees. So I think it's a very interesting move.
So I don't get that whole thing, to be honest with you.
You know, a lot of whistleblowers, when they're dealing with journalists, eventually come out. Assange is an example.
They think they have the whistleblower's name, by the way. So that
who is now, they? The Republicans?
It's out there. It's out there. I heard it on NPR this morning.
Trump tweeted that they know who it is, so I don't know what that means. You can't take him at his word.
Well, let's assume he's not lying for once, and they do know it. It's interesting that the whistleblower and his attorneys are playing with this. The way that they are, and saying, okay, we'll deal with you, and if you submit written questions, we'll answer the written questions. We do know that, or at least we think, that he or she, and I should say that, is from the intelligence community.
Yeah, the New York Times reported on that
long ago
early.
That he was a CIA agent.
Right.
I think it's a very clever move to say, well, we'll deal directly with the Republicans on the committee.
Nunes.
Because this undermines the argument that this is all just concocted by the Democrats and they're not following the proper process, et cetera. Say, okay, well, Republicans ask in writing whatever you want.
Okay, here's a good question. Are you a Democrat? I mean, in other words, if they ask that question, what are they like? And he's saying he'll answer, or she is, will answer any question you have. If they are a Democrat, will they say, yes, I'm a Democrat? Interesting.
Yeah. Or you can say that's not relevant. Or she can say that's not relevant.
Yeah, that's an answer, too.
Yeah.
Okay, Teresa, okay. Trump, did we read that, is calling for the outing of whistleblowers?
Yes. 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 Yes, okay. That's what we're talking
okay.
about.
Okay, and Jerry says, Troy mayoral race. Thanks for discussing the Troy mayoral race. Please emphasize that McLaughlin is supporting Wiltshire, and that's why he wanted Real out. I'm wondering if this bait and switch constitutes election fraud. McLaughlin wants to get his clutches on Troy, and we need to keep him from succeeding. And that's from Jerry.
No, it's not election fraud. It's just election shenanigans.
We get a lot of letters like this. Say, arrest him.
Yeah, right. No, it's not fraud. It's just
lock him up.
Yeah, lock him up.
I like the MMA chant, which was headlock him up.
Now, did your son attend that?
He did. He said he was 6 seats away from McCarthy and Trump and the two.
Oh, was that where
Trumps.
They said lock him
any,
up at
did
the
he
MMA?
Headlock him up.
You're kidding.
And they had signed. Well, it was kind of competing. It was mixed. Trump expected to go into cheers, and there was some cheering, but the booers out.
Wow,
booed him.
That's really interesting, because one would think that would be his base.
Still New York City.
He thought it was. Yeah, it's still New York City.
Oh, it's New
exactly.
York City, but still, yeah. still, that's yeah. really interesting.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We will go on to new issues, and we'll talk about all kinds of other stuff, including Syria and Hong Kong. We will do that after this short break. We do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, Sarah Rogerson, Rosemary Armeo, and Libby Post make up the panel. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Sarah Rogerson, Libby Post, Rosemary Armeo, and James Ketterer. We welcome your letters. Alan has a few.
A few is right. Okay. And we heard from Frank, and the title of his note is Whistleblower. Hello, panel. A Daily Beast article last week reported that a top aide to Representative Devin Nunes is revealing information on and the name of the whistleblower. He's also planting misinformation in the public arena about this patriot. What are the legal ramifications of this? For that, we go to our lawyer, Sarah.
Ugh, I don't know.
I suspect there are none.
I suspect that, again, this goes back to normative implications about how we handle whistleblowers, right? And I think one of the things that the whistleblowers' lawyers are doing that's smart is perhaps preserving whistleblowing culture as we know it.
Well, this certainly is a law, and the law says whistleblowing is very important, so we're going to protect whistleblowers. Now, who would you want to protect them more from than the president of the United States?
It's the whole point, yeah.
Well, not just the president, but the target of his whistleblowing. That's the whole idea of whistleblowing, is you have an outlet to complain about wrongdoing by hires up. And here's the guy who has been accused who's now going to retaliate. It seems to go. I think there are federal laws on this. I don't know. I don't think that we've ever had a case like this where it's the president trying to out him, the president and his minions.
You know, and it's not just a question of what's legal.
Right.
It also is what works for government, what works in setting policy. I mean, the State Department very wisely, in addition to this whistleblower statute that they're covered by, as all of government is, they've set up internally something called the dissent channel, that someone somewhere in the bureaucracy, if they've tried everything else and they feel so strongly about something and they can't get their dissent through the system, there's a special way that they can get it right up to the top. They can use this dissent channel. we need that in government. We need people to speak up against things that they think are not going well for whatever reason, either because they think it's illegal or it's just a bad idea.
And, you know, the other thing about enforcement that is so fascinating to me is the whole issue of the Justice Department. So we issue subpoenas to four guys from the White House to show up today.
And they didn't.
And they're not.
Yeah.
And they're not. Now, that's a subpoena. It's a violation of a congressional subpoena. What are you going to do with them? Well, you should throw them in jail. Yeah. That Justice Department is going to throw them in jail? Right. That is a riot. They're not going to do it. So, you know, the only thing you can do is have them on the list of people who have defied law.
Let me ask Sarah on that. So somebody defies a congressional subpoena. Can the Capitol Police go arrest them?
And put them where?
Not on their own accord. It would have to be someone in Congress to do it. Fareed Zakaria did a special on impeachment. It was really interesting this weekend. And he says that's the real constitutional crisis that we're facing right now, that at being challenged is the separation of powers. Mm-hmm. And the executive branch never before has defied congressional oversight, even if you remember Nixon, when told by the Supreme Court, by the judiciary, turn over the tapes. He turned them over. He answered the subpoenas from Congress. And Trump has said, no, we're going to obstruct in every way. We don't approve of this. We don't think this is valid. And so we are not going to respond to any of the congressional oversight demands. That's a challenge.
And that's how totalitarianism and fascism.
But the Congress does have their own police force. That's what I'm saying. So I'm wondering, how does that work?
And it requires an order. There has to be a prerequisite order. And I know that there have been people who have gone to jail and served time for refusing to answer subpoenas during the pendency in the Clinton impeachment.
But who's going to enforce? There's no Justice Department to do that right now.
You don't necessarily need the Justice Department. There are different layers of law enforcement, and I can look up that because I just spent time looking up the idea that the Whistleblower Protection Act is only has only been around for a couple of decades.
Sure.
So I think what we're going to see here is perhaps either an expansion of rights and remedies under the Whistleblower Protection Act, some sort of articulation around what happens if, potentially, if courts have to take up these issues of leaks on the arrest side of things.
Who'll do it? I mean, who will
expand
it? It'll end
up in the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah.
Because
this Supreme Court is gonna do that.
Or in a circuit court.
It'll still end up in the Supreme Court. And it's interesting because, yes, it is a conservatively tilted court, but it also is an institutionally minded court, too. Roberts has maintained up to now the distinct branches of government. That's what's at stake.
Uh-huh. Well, you're absolutely right. And Roberts does become a key player. Nevertheless, he is a Republican, and we'll see. But not a Trumpian Republican.
Right. I think he wants a legacy.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
He does not want to become the justice under whom the Supreme Court became a partisan body.
Right. I think he wants his own legacy, and I think he'll become the William Kennedy.
The question is, will he be? Where will I be in the history books?
Yeah, right. Yeah. What side of it will I be on? So he'll become the Anthony Kennedy of the court.
Well, Brenda wrote, according to Today's Times, Trump is still doing well in the battleground states, likely to decide his reelection. That's true, by the way. Until something is done about the Electoral College, let's snap our fingers and change the Electoral College. That ain't going to happen. All of our talking and canvassing, telephoning, and working for Democratic candidates may likely be for naught. Well, you know, Brenda, we've been having a big discussion amongst I know this is incorrect, but us panelists here, which is when
That's
people
correct.
Predict.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Well, as the editor, I would like to say that is correct.
If in fact, we say or somebody says on the panel, like Rosemary, this is not going well, Trump will be reelected. Does that dispirit, that's the question, does that dispirit, that's an analytic perfectly acceptable thing for somebody to say, but should we refrain from saying it because it will make Democrats not go out and vote because they say, it's all fixed?
No. Is it our role here to try to bolster the political positions of one group over another? No, our role, I think, here is to analyze the news and let the chips fall where they may. If people are going to stay home, that's their own stupid decision.
As journalists, you're trained to follow the story, to put out the evidence and the facts, and you are not responsible for the consequences. Although, of course, you try to minimize harm because you really do feel responsible. It's a very touchy thing. So if I say we're doomed and people don't vote because I say that, they're not very good voters in the first place, are they?
Well, I mean, no, you all are correct. But what if, in fact, the future of the United States as a constitutional Republican democracy is at stake here,
right?
Because of what is said in this room or rooms like this.
I think we have a responsibility to get people engaged in the issues and make sure that they go out and vote.
You do?
I do think we have that responsibility, absolutely. People look to us. Part of the problem in this country right now is we have a paucity of leadership. It's what's happening in the Democratic Party. There's no clear, moral, value-driven leader, and so we're...
You don't think Pelosi's that?
I think Pelosi is that, but not in the cast of characters who's running, so we're floundering right now for a nominee. Leadership is so incredibly important, and people yearn for that. And they want a leader. Now, Trump, as much as we may despise him, led his people. It's clear that he did.
He's a charismatic leader.
Right. He's a charismatic leader. We need that on our side. Obama was a charismatic leader. John F. Kennedy was a charismatic leader. You know,
At least in retrospect.
He put out, ask not what you can do for your country. You know, that whole thing shaped a generation. And so I think we do have a responsibility.
Jim, okay, so that's all very nice and uplifting.
For getting people engaged.
At base, though, what you said, Libby, is we do not have what we need.
Right, yes.
Which is the definition of doom.
Okay. No.
Yeah, but I think that it's, I mean, the leadership should be a function of something else. And that, it really has to start with something else you said, Libby, which is, citizens need to be deeply engaged in these issues. They need to be thinking about them.
Yes.
They need to educate themselves. And then, you know, they may vote in a way that I don't like, but as long as they vote and they engage those issues, that is the incredibly important starting point. And when people say, well, if I'm not inspired to do it, I'm going to stay home, or that, you know, my mind was somehow altered by reading too much social media or something. You know, if we don't have as a starting point an educated, informed, engaged citizenry, everything else falls apart.
Well, you know,
everything.
Implicit in Libby's remarks is, I think, and I apologize if I'm wrong, that we don't have a candidate who is going to inspire that kind of confidence. Now, but I said, and I said it earlier today, implicit in that is the belief, for example, that Elizabeth Warren, who is coming up so quickly, can't possibly win an election. And I say it may really come down to Elizabeth Warren versus Trump. And there may be such a heavy, after all, we see polls this morning that say half the country wants Trump out of there, impeached and convicted.
I think we'll have an anybody but Trump vote is what
well,
will
come could,
out.
Well, there could be.
Yes.
There could be in that. And Elizabeth Warren could prove to be much more charismatic than people are giving her credit for because she is on the left of things. Now, Medicare for All, some people think will be her undoing and the taxation of that. But I, you know, I just don't know yet. I think it's too early.
It is too early. It's way too early. We need to wait to see how everything, you know. But I can tell you this, you know, people, last night we were at Cafe Lena and I and I said
something.
Where
the Berkshire Ramblers will be playing soon.
Oh, good. No, we saw Anne Hampton Calloway, and she does this thing where she writes a song from the stage with the people. So I spoke out and said something. And so somebody recognized my voice and, you know, came up to me and, you know, blah, 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 which is lovely. But you know, people want us to be talking about what we can do to make a better planet and a better nation and a better community. I really feel that way because people come up and say, thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's so important for you to be talking about these issues. So, I mean, yes, we have 400,000 people who listen to us. Not every one of them are Democrats.
But that's why we had
that.
A one-day fund drive.
Right. That's right. But it's really important for us to recognize the power of our voices right here, right now.
As long as people are engaging the issues, if a lot of them end up disagreeing with me, I'm okay with that.
I'm not. That's why I'm so negative. I think that Trump's people are engaged. They do vote. They are sticking with him. Why are not the Democrats? Whether it's because I don't want Trump,
well,
anybody other than him, mm-hmm. or people, you know, the young people who want an actual environmental policy.
Well, you don't know
they're not voting.
Hey, Rosemary, we have a blue United States
right.
House of Representatives right.
right
now.
I mean, come
somebody
on.
Somebody is engaged.
Yep. Let's see what
happened last
year, what's going to happen tomorrow. And, Jim, as much as I agree with you that I want people to be thinking about this, that's not what drives people anymore. That's not what drives people. It's emotion.
Then we're in deeper trouble than I thought.
No, we're
not. If it's just that.
No, because Obama got elected on the emotion of hope.
Doomed, is that what you're saying?
That's true.
I didn't say
okay.
it.
Okay. Obama
I say
was
it too much.
Obama was elected on the emotion and value of hope.
But election is just one day in the life of a Republican. We then have to run the country.
I
we
get
have
that.
To do things
I
that require
that.
Thinking,
but
making decisions,
that's right. and the
weighing options.
And the people that we elect need to have those skills. But the people who are pulling the lever respond to the emotional part.
Meanwhile,
why do you think Trump got elected? Sorry.
Meanwhile, in poll land, Washington Post mm-hmm. ABC News poll is showing Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg rising.
That's an interesting ticket, don't you think?
And also, and I think equally interesting is the fact that in Iowa and elsewhere, Joe Biden is having great difficulty. That was written about his, that they went and put all of the noisemakers and the signs in the chairs for the people at his rally, and nobody came to the rally, so they just kind of collected them. And it was really sad. The whole thing seemed really sad.
Except that the polls are also showing that collectively in the United States, Biden is still number one. Not by a lot, 5 points, 6 points, but he is number one. However, you're right, Joe. When you come to New Hampshire or you come to Iowa, there could be real trouble for Biden. And that may mean that the others will follow suit. However,
I mean, this is a guy who was a front runner there and now is running fourth.
That's true. But he's not running fourth in terms of the collective poll in the United States.
Yet.
Where he's not yet. That's right. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's still ahead. I think that this is really dangerous for him because New Hampshire and Iowa are going to be trendsetters, maybe for the other states. Now, South Carolina is still doing pretty well. Libby, I don't know if you saw it. But there was a senior black leader who said older blacks don't like the fact
that
he's
Buttigieg
is gay.
Right.
Pete Buttigieg.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, it's true. It's true. He'll have a hard time in the South. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah,
I see the continuing support of Biden, who I think has completely collapsed, is more a protest against the next two candidates, Warren and
Sanders.
And Sanders,
so?
Because they want them to be more moderate, which they are not. They are not moderates. And I think Trump has succeeded in his campaign against Biden, who really could have beat him, would have beat him, perhaps.
One more letter.
Pushed him out.
If I may, Joe. Yes or no?
Yes, please.
Yes, no.
Please.
Neil says, Russia. You folks are asking the wrong question about Trump and Russia. The question isn't why Trump favors Putin. It's why the supposedly anti-communist Republicans are letting him get away with it. The answer is that Russia is not a communist country. It is an autocratic kleptocracy where oligarchs rule, which is exactly the Republican Party's vision for America. Well, there are a couple of implicit parts of that, one of which I think is that Russia hasn't been a communist nation for a long time,
right.
including it was a statist.
Right.
It
was it ever? It never was, really.
It was a statist institution to begin with, right? So, and Putin has certainly continued that. My question, of course, is what's the relationship, and it always has been, between Trump and Putin?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we have time for one more topic. Do we want it to be Hong Kong or Syria?
Well, we've got Jim.
Jim, which one do you want to take?
How about Hong Kong?
Hong Kong for 300. Yeah. Lock it in.
Right.
So the story here being that Hong Kong protesters are calling for the U.S. to help. China is seeing a conspiracy. The United States, viewed as a champion of democracy, occupies a symbolic role in the protests. Activists now want President Trump to take a tougher stand against Beijing. Now what?
You know, as I've been watching this from Egypt, two things have jumped out at me. I think one that you've probably already covered weeks ago, but I think is still interesting, which is the NBA response, the National Basketball Association, and how that has played out. And secondly, that we see, you know, sort of a steady stream of news articles about what's happening on college campuses with Chinese students on college campuses, some who support the protests in Hong Kong, others who do not, and the sense by those who support the protests that they're being reported on,
yes,
and it's being reported back, and it will affect their lives. And this is a very interesting development, not only so how the U.S. government will or won't respond to the protesters, but how will colleges across the United States respond to this, which is a really potentially chilling attack on academic freedom at the student level. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
universities are such powerhouses of leadership on these. I've heard them speak out on what issues in the past year, 2 years, 3 years.
Yeah, well,
hopeful.
An American asylum law, which is the Asylum Protections and Convention Against Torture Protections that would ordinarily protect folks like this, are all over the place in terms of what this administration is deciding to honor, in terms of what qualifies as a well-founded fear of past persecution or a well-founded fear of future persecution based on political opinion, for example.
Yeah, so that's at the governmental level. But then you have campuses across this country that over the past 20 years have become heavily reliant on Chinese students coming and paying full tuition, and that the prospect of losing that stream of students and money, I think, is putting them in a very difficult spot, these colleges, and they're not quite knowing what to do and how to respond.
And some of them are state schools.
Yeah, state schools, which have seen a huge reduction in their state support for a long time, and which I think is really misguided, number one, and then have turned to recruiting international students so they can pay cash on the barrel head. And that seems all well and good, and there's ways to promote it. But then when you run into these politics, that's much more difficult.
When are you coming back to the United States?
I'm not quite sure.
All right.
But I'm looking forward to being back here.
All right. But you'll let us know when you come back.
Well, Libby, come in. No, I'm so sorry. Rosemary came back.
Yeah.
Remember when you came back, Rosemary?
Yes.
It was just a few weeks ago.
But you're still here.
Much longer. Right. Yeah. It's not by choice. Unlike you, I don't want to be here right now. I hate seeing what's going on. You can see how pessimistic I have become. Yeah. No, I would rather be overseas.
All right.
You'd rather be overseas?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, that's like a dark turn, but all right.
Sorry. I'm trying not to.
James Ketterer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for
having
me.
Safe travels, and be well.
We'll be
thinking of you, and we look forward to seeing you soon. Rosemary, Libby, Sarah, Alan, thank you. We'll be back after this.